Prepare to experience the strongest radio allowable by law. Secrets will be revealed. Myths dispelled. From the studio gym where excuses never apply, it's Superhuman Radio with your host, Carl Lenore.
Welcome back to another episode of Superhuman Radio. I had to put a new microphone in today. Believe that? A microphone I had for 14 years. It's finally died on me. There you go. We have a good show today. I'm going to be talking about hydration throughout the entire show. And we're going to talk about a study that was just published. Talking about why it's even more important for us older guys, especially us older guys who train hard. Of course, before we do any of that, we have to thank our title sponsor, Legendary Foods. The website is eatlegendary.com. The code is SHR10 for 10% off your entire purchase. If you're not familiar with Legendary Foods, you will want to try one of their tasty pastries. It's basically a Pop-Tart with 9 grams of high-quality, high-leucine protein, less than 1 gram of sugar, and in between 3 and 4 impact carbohydrates. They taste delicious. They actually taste better than Pop-Tarts. And while you're there, get some of their nut butters and spread the nut butter, your favorite nut butter, on one Pop-Tart. Put it together and make a Pop-Tart sandwich with their nut butters. Unbelievable, I promise you. If you feel like eating something decadent that's actually not loaded with sugar or carbs, it's a great way to go. So check it out. All right, so we're going to get my guest on now, and he is Robert Mead. He's a doctoral student at the University of Ottawa. How are you, Robert?
Good. How are you, Carl?
Wonderful. Wonderful. So we're going to talk about a study that was just published, and it was published in the journal. I'm trying to think what journal it was. Which journal was it?
The Journal of Physiology.
Thank you. There it is. Journal of Physiology. It was published looking at the relationship between temperature regulation and dehydration. And you found some interesting things, but before we go there, why this study? What led up to this study? What work preceded this study that this need to be looked at?
Yeah, so this was actually a series of two studies that we conducted over the past 2 or 3 years. Essentially, when we think about dehydration and body temperature regulation, we know from work dating back years and years, mostly done with the U.S. Army, that as we become dehydrated, what we see is our ability to lose heat and regulate body temperature is adjusted. Why this is thought to occur is if we are becoming dehydrated, if we let our body run a little bit hotter, it kind of makes thermoregulation a bit more efficient. So what we can basically do is sacrifice a bit of body temperature regulation so we can preserve fluid. We don't need to sweat as much. But most of this work had been done up until this point in younger adults, kind of either in a military or a occupational worker context. And we really didn't know if this kind of these same mechanisms translated to older individuals. So in this first study, which was published in 2019, essentially what we did was we had groups of young and older adults come into the laboratory. They walked on a treadmill with a poncho on until they lost around 4% of their body weight, which worked out to be about 7 pounds, so quite a large dehydration. And then we have a specialized device, and we can get into it in a couple of minutes, but in our laboratory, we can measure exactly how much heat someone is dissipating from their body. So we completed the trial, or each group, sorry, completed the trial once when they were dehydrated or adequately hydrated and once when they were dehydrated. And what we basically saw was, in line with previous work, the younger adults, they lost less heat and they got hotter when they were dehydrated. But we didn't see this reduction in the older adults. So even though when they were adequately hydrated, they lost less heat than the younger adults, because as we get older, our regulation of body temperature becomes less efficient. There was no sort of this adjustment that we saw when they were dehydrated. Now, in the study that was just recently published, essentially we wanted to kind of probe a little bit deeper into why this may be occurring. So when we become dehydrated, there's two things happening. Specifically, when we become dehydrated from sweating, there's different kinds of dehydration. But as we sweat, we're losing fluid from the body, and that's lost mainly from the blood. as everyone knows, sweat is quite salty. We're also losing salt as it happens, but the sweat glands are actually very good at absorbing some of that salt back. So not only are we seeing a reduction in blood volume, we're also seeing an increase in the saltiness of our blood, or the osmolality as we've measured in this this study. And this basically just, for lack of getting it too far into it, represents how the electrolyte content of fluids in the body. Now, based on some other work that had been done a long time ago, or from our lab and other labs as well, we kind of thought that if one of these systems was likely not working as efficiently in the older adults, it was likely the osmolality system. So we were thinking that the older adults respond less efficiently to this increase in osmolality. So to assess this in this study, we skipped the dehydration, and instead we gave a group of young and older adults again an infusion of saline through an IV. In one trial, the saline was just your normal 0.9% saline, so that's the same kind of osmolality as your blood. And then in another trial, we used 3% saline, so that's about triple the osmolality of the blood. We then had them again in the calorimeter do some exercise with an hour of exercise at about 50% of maximum oxygen uptake, and we saw pretty well the same finding. So leads us to believe that the kind of lack of an adjustment, or the blunted adjustment to dehydration, is probably due to reduced osmotic sensitivity as we get older.
So in the case of older men, they're going to end up tempting, let's say, in extreme conditions, heat stroke, in an effort for the body to maintain its osmolality and fluid content, right?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, it shouldn't have much of an effect on the risk of kind of, it's tough to say, but the risk of kind of getting to very elevated body temperatures, because regardless of whether they were dehydrated or euhydrated or adequately hydrated, or, you know, hyperosmotic, isoosmotic, we saw that there was no difference in the kind of end core temperature they achieved. Where we kind of thought this was significant was that what this basically means is, as we're exercising, in older adults, we don't see that kind of compensatory reduction in further sweat losses, and in the first day, we actually saw that they were achieving higher heart rates. So the kind of strain on the cardiovascular system seemed to be a little bit higher. You then kind of, and now this is again in very, you know, structured laboratory conditions, but then when you kind of add that to research going back a long while, showing that, you know, as we get older, maybe our thirst isn't so sensitive, our kidneys don't work quite as efficiently, we think that the risk of dehydration may be increased in older adults. So when you're exposed to a heat wave or working in the heat, that's where the risk may come in. So it's a kind of combined age-related reductions in our ability to dissipate heat and regulate body temperature, as well as a reduction in our ability to kind of maintain adequate hydration.
So when we talk about hydration, we talk about drinking water, right? Mm-hmm. But is water by itself adequate to achieve hydration, or should we also be looking at electrolytes in this process as well?
Yeah, so like you said, a lot of the kind of guidance around this coming from, you know, sporting organizations, public health, is drink water, drink water, drink water. A big part of that is because, as like I mentioned, as we're sweating, we typically are losing water in greater proportion than we are salts, sodium, potassium, that sort of thing from the sweat. Certainly drinking too much water is not the healthiest thing. Everyone's heard of water toxicity and that sort of thing. It's called hyponatremia, where essentially if you're only putting back just non-mineral water, then you can potentially dilute the electrolytes you do have. As far as I understand it, unless we're talking about, you know, long-term ultra marathons, marathons in the heat, that sort of thing, typically our diet is good to replace those the electrolytes we're losing in any sort of physical activity. But we do need to keep in mind that, you know, just shoveling on the water is not going to necessarily protect us either.
So we have a viewer whose security settings won't let their Facebook name come through. And this is really interesting. Hydration depends on humidity, environmental temperature, physical activity, intensity, BMI, and plasma osmolality, which is related with sodium concentrations. But it even goes further than that, really, when you think about it. So you mentioned marathon runners, right?
Mm-hmm.
Marathon runners shouldn't drink too much water because their kidneys actually undergo a blockade process at some point. And the osmolality of their blood can change dramatically. We've heard stories about marathon runners drinking too much just water, not like a sports drink with electrolytes and stuff like that, and literally passing out because of the change in mineral ratios or electrolyte ratios in their blood. So when we talk about hydration, this is a multifactorial process. It's very hard to give guidance and say, well, for every hour you train, drink, you know, 2 ounces or 6 ounces. You can't, because how hard are you training? How much are you sweating? I read a study once that showed that athletes, depending on the environment that they're training in, can lose up to 2,300 milligrams of sodium per liter of sweat. That's a lot of sodium. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, if you look at how much you can sweat, there's evidence that you can sweat anywhere between 2 and 5 liters of sweat in a single 1 hour training session. Again, depending on the temperature of the environment, how hard you're training. So when we talk about hydration, it's hard to give guidance, isn't it?
Absolutely. There is kind of an ongoing debate in the field. There's just kind of those two camps, like you had mentioned. There is the camp saying, you know, you could potentially have reductions in performance if you're not adequately hydrating. And there is evidence to support that. There is also the other side where, you know, when you're in a situation, heavy work, like a marathon, you know, like you said, your body is kind of set up to preserve fluid, but there's other things happening as well. Another big thing with marathon running and hard work, and especially in the heat, is that we have a reduction in kind of flow to the gut. And too much water loading on, I'm sure many people have experienced this, but you can not feel so good in the stomach when that happens.
Yeah, it just sits there. It doesn't move.
Yeah.
You can actually hear it sloshing around as you're moving sometimes.
Yeah. So there is a lot of different factors to consider. And like the viewer had mentioned, all of those factors, obviously, if it's hot outside, we need to sweat more. If it's humid, the sweat we are sweating is not evaporating, so it's not actually contributing to thermoregulation. The larger we are, the more weight we have to carry around, the more heat we're producing just from that. So it's very hard to kind of give targeted guidance on how much we should be drinking. You couple that as well with our ability to actually what you would call spot check hydration status. So a single measure you give to someone, you know, you say, is that person hydrated or not, is not very good. So, it's kind of one of those things that when we talk about it, there's a lot of kind of, confusion and, conflicting information out there for sure.
Now, is it just enough? Is it adequate enough to just say, well, when you're thirsty, drink more water? Or do older adults present some sort of unique situation in that area?
Yeah, so there is that kind of you know, notion that as we get older, we tend to be dehydrated more. This is I wouldn't say a myth, but it's a little bit. It's not that easy. Essentially, what you do see is if you have older adults admitted to a hospital, or those, you know, living in care homes, for instance, with you know, certain neurological diseases, they do tend to kind of be dehydrated often. But if we age and, you know, we don't develop any of these conditions and we're active in that sort of thing, like the gentleman behind me, we don't see that kind of same dehydration in just everyday life. Typically older adults maintain hydration adequately. Where the kind of trick comes in is that as we age, even what we'll call healthy aging, we do see that our ability to replace fluids when we lose them is kind of, it lags a little bit. So it might take longer for us to regain that state of hydration. Now, where the research kind of needs to go in our field for sure, or my field, I guess, with the heat stress, is that does that place someone at risk during prolonged activity? Certainly, we know that even younger adults, they do undergo what's called voluntary dehydration, so they won't actually drink to replace fluid,
right,
or enough fluid to maintain body mass or the hydration status. We know as well that older adults, they seem to undergo a little bit greater voluntary dehydration. What we don't really have a good understanding of now is, does that lead to more risk down the road? Or in most cases, is this kind of a level of dehydration going to be something that we can easily manage? So we're still not quite sure on that one, I don't think.
So there's another phenomenon that I notice, and in non-athletic older people, they tend not to drink water. They tend to go to diet sodas, you know, coffee, and beverages that don't really, you know, a lot of people think, oh, I'm drinking coffee, there's water in here. No, it doesn't do the same thing in your body that just plain water does. And I find older adults who are not athletic tend to not drink water. Or they can go for days, I mean, except taking a medication. You know, they'll take their medication, they'll take a sip and put it down. But then they'll grab their diet soda and finish that. So that could present another lifestyle challenge. It could be people out there, average people who show up in hospitals for average reasons, who are dehydrated because they just don't drink water. They think they drink a lot of liquids, but it's just not water.
Yeah, absolutely. In most of those cases, I think the water that you are consuming does add to that, you know, body kind of pool of water. Whether or not, I'm not saying that you don't need to drink water, drink soft drinks, that sort of thing. This does bring another kind of interesting factor we need to consider when we're talking about hydration, is that there's also that kind of hedonic component to it, where most of the time, even people who are drinking, who are active and, you know they're not watching they're watching their soft drink intake. A lot of times the reason we drink is not because we're thirsty, is because, you know, social cues tell us we should, you know, we're at dinner or something like that. Or in the case of maybe if you're having a few beers after work, you're not actually looking for that fluid. You're looking for other substances in the fluid.
Yeah.
So it just kind of complicates the situation a little bit further. And there's tons of research on that as well, showing that, you know, if you offer someone, for instance, cold versus hot water, I think this one's probably pretty obvious, during prolonged treadmill walking in the heat, they're more likely to drink more cold water. If you flavor that water, then they're more likely to drink with, you know, like a meal or something like that. They're more likely to drink that flavored water because it's palatable or it's pleasing. And so this just adds another layer of complication when we talk about, you know, what is hydration? How much do we need? How do we, without measuring our, you know, our blood, how do we maintain our own hydration?
So there's another phenomenon that's actually beneficial to adaptations from training. And that is when the body reaches a certain temperature, and usually this is an uncomfortable temperature for most people, it turns on a phenomenon called heat shock proteins in muscles. And heat shock proteins in muscle actually aid us in the supercompensation that we desire from exercise. So if someone is training in a very, very hot environment, should they, by drinking more water, are they actually avoiding that, reaching that body heat, you think? Or does your body's going to get that as hot as it can get no matter how much water you drink? Does it even matter?
Yeah, this is actually a field of open debate right now. And it's funny that you bring that up. One of the postdocs working in our laboratory, Dr. Ashley Ackerman, actually has done quite a bit of research on this. This, though, is another field where there's just so much. The thing with studying this kind of factor is it's really hard to kind of, because all these systems are interrelated, to tease out the bits. I don't think there's good information on it right now. When we're talking about adapting to any sort of stress, the thing we got to consider with the kind of competing influences of exercise and heat is, in one case, we say, okay, maybe if we become dehydrated, we're going to get hotter, and that might kind of spur on that heat shock protein response. On the other side of that coin, if we become dehydrated and maybe we're not able to exercise quite as long or we want to stop earlier, we're not necessarily getting the actual training time in, which of course will also drive that response. So right now, I don't think there's much consensus on, you know, is it better to be dehydrated or keep your fluid maintained? But you'd have to talk to Dr. Ackerman about that, I think.
Let's take a minute to take some comments and questions from the audience. David Ellison said, happy Thanksgiving to Robert. You're in Canada. This is your Thanksgiving right now, right?
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving to you. This has to be – so this person's Facebook username is not coming through, but I'm willing to bet that this is Dr. George Touliatos from Greece. Just because of the comments that he's making. George, whoever's making these posts, could you just post your name? This is like, what's my line? You know, we have to guess the other person's job. But he talks about sodium chloride and obviously losing potassium in training and sweating. And then he goes on to talk about the isotonic beverages, which he's talking about. Gatorade and things like that. In fact, we're going to have Element on at the end of today's show. They just became a new sponsor, and so I figured this would be a great show to drop them in at the end. And they are an electrolyte product with no sugar, no B vitamins, no garbage, just minerals. But he talks about the desire to drink extra water coming from the need to replenish sodium chloride. He says, by eating carbs, we elevate plasma osmolality. This is observed in highly in bodybuilding during carb loading. Yeah, sometimes it overflows under your skin and you look soft. Veins pump up due to higher osmolality, and also the desire to drink water increases in order to dilute plasma concentrations. That's an interesting phenomenon that I was not aware of. It's got to be him. Yeah, look, I said, who is this? I said, it's got to be Dr. George Touliatos. He's in Greece. He's a wonderful doctor. He's been on my show numerous times. He's brilliant. And he's pumping out comments here. Caffeine and ethanol block vasopressin, or ADH, that flushes water and dehydrates. Interesting. Thanks for your contributions today, George. Yeah, he says, yes, Carl, that's me. Yeah, I knew it was. I'm reading them thinking, this can only be George typing this stuff. All right, so here's what I want to do. I want to hit a quick commercial break. When we come back, we'll continue discussing this this study. And also, what older men need to know and do in order to overcome this potential for being dehydrated. Okay, so we're going to take one quick commercial break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Mind Bullet is a kratom product derived from the coffee family to boost energy and creative juices. Mind Bullet comes in both pill and liquid form for the ultimate pre-workout supplement. When needing a little pick-me-up or to get through the morning fog, Mind Bullet will set your productive course fast. Go to shrnetwork.biz/mindbullet, all one word, today, and save 20%. No subscription required. That's shrnetwork.biz/mindbullet. Get yours today.
Whether your goal is to build muscle or burn fat, you'll find everything you need at Redcon One. Need help getting a good night's sleep? Try Fade Out, or the most popular pre-workout supplement on the market today, Total War. Sign up for their new Transformation Challenge and win $10,000. Or shop for apparel that people at the gym will know that you are serious about your training. Need a testosterone booster that works? Check out Boomstick. Whatever you need, you'll find the best quality supplements on the market at Redcon One. Go to RedconOne.com. That's R-E-D-C-O-N, the number one.com, or go to superhumanradio.net and click the Redcon One banner ad today.
I love beef. And if you love beef, listen up. I've discovered the best tasting beef in the world, and that's not an exaggeration, at Piedmontese.com. The Piedmontese breed is famous from Italy for being lean and unbelievably tender, with half the fat and calories of traditional beef. Even typically tough cuts are tender when it comes from the Piedmontese cows. And for the first time ever, Piedmontese cows are being raised here in the USA.
Get 25% off all beef and free shipping on orders of $100 or more
at Piedmontese.com with code SHR. Go to P-I-E-D-M-O-N-T-E-S-E.com. BONTESE.com and use code SHR today. You will never eat any other type of beef ever again.
You've heard me talk about the chill pill on the show and how effective it is at helping people who suffer from social anxiety or sometimes when you just want to take the edge off to a long, stressful day. Well, listen to this story from Dylan Goutreau.
Definitely takes anxiety away, which I have a long history of having. Started out at 2 milligrams a day of Xanax. That was at 8 years old. And so I stopped using benzos 3 years ago. Extremely difficult. Yeah, so I spent about 3 years trying to find anything and everything I could that would be healthy for me to help with anxiety. Because I'm talking, you know, full bull out panic attack. The chill pill was the first thing that I've found that actually in the middle of a panic attack I can take. And it definitely subsides.
Go to drseeds.com. That's DRSEEDS.com. Use coupon code SHR and save 20% off your first bottle of the chill pill. Check it out. I promise this is one supplement that delivers. Chronic stress leaves us tired, distracted, and physically vulnerable. Apollo Neuro is here to help you take control. Apollo Neuro is a new wearable that trains your nervous system to be more resilient to stress. Apollo's gentle vibrations use your sense of touch to help you recover from stress, going from fight or flight to rest and digest so you can relax, get to sleep, focus, and stay healthy. Developed by physicians and neuroscientists, Apollo Neuro has been tested in multiple clinical trials and is proven to improve heart rate variability, the key biometric of stress. Special offer for friends of Superhuman Radio. Try Apollo Neuro today and get 15% off your purchase at apolloneuro.com/superhuman. That's apolloneuro.com/superhuman.
When craving a snack, reach for a Select Savory Snack sugar-free biltong, the healthy alternative to sugar-laden beef jerky. They use a fattier cut of beef, making it more tender and flavorful. For mealtime, choose from their 63 seasonings, which are sugar and additive-free. From chipotle rub to savory pumpkin spice, you'll find an option to suit your palate. Go to shrnetwork.biz/SSS today. Use code SHR15 to save 15% on any meat snack or seasoning. Savor the flavor today.
You're listening to the Superhuman Channel. We're ripped and we're ready.
We're ripped and we're ready. Welcome back. We're talking with Robert Mead. He's a doctoral student at the University of Ottawa. And we're talking about hydration and especially older individuals, which tend to probably be more dehydrated because they don't drink enough water, and perhaps they don't get enough of the important electrolyte minerals in their diet. So what should older individuals be thinking about? Like if they are training, if they do, you know, run, go to the gym and train, or like me, sit in 180-degree sauna a few times a week.
Yeah, so in terms of hydration, obviously the big kind of takeaway from this research, as well as a lot of the research that preceded it, is that we may not, as we get older, have the same ability to assess how dehydrated we are. So that means we might need some more external cues to kind of replace water. And these are going to be really boring, but they're the kind of the best methods we have going. So first thing is you can always check the color of your urine. After a long day or in the morning, after a long training session, when there's enough time for kind of any sort of differences in fluid regulation over the day to kind of show up in the urine. If you're waking up and your urine is extremely dark, probably means that you need to take in a bit more fluid during the day. What really easy one to do, you know, if you're training at the gym or you're running from home, is just measure your body weight before and after. If you know you normally sit around 175 pounds, you should try to maintain that. You come home and you're maybe 170 pounds. You know that maybe not right away, but over at least before the next training session, you should try to put back that water. And in terms of really hard training sessions, and this goes for more than just dehydration, for work, or especially if it's hot out, a lot of times we say just using the buddy system, having a training partner who kind of knows your normal energy levels and how you normally act. And if they notice anything is out of the ordinary, then that might be the time to call it for the day, or, you know, seek medical attention if necessary. Unfortunately, there's no real silver bullet. It's just you got to be diligent and watch your fluid levels, essentially.
You know, the straw-colored urine has always been a good one for me. Very, 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 very rarely is my urine dark. It's always that. It's not yellow, like clear yellow, but it's always that straw color. And for me, that tells me that I'm drinking enough water. But I've been actively drinking water for decades now because I was a hard training athlete for much of my life, and I'm still hard training for my age. I don't squat and deadlift what I used to. That doesn't mean I couldn't if I trained back that, you know, for that purpose. But I mean, I'll drink three of these in a show just because I get thirsty and I want to drink. But there was a study we discussed on this show back in 2008 that showed that even a 10% reduction in fluid in the body, which is the beginnings of dehydration, maybe that is frank dehydration, I forget what it was, caused a dramatic drop in strength. Because when we talk about strength, people don't understand this, but powerful anabolic steroids that impart great strength gains, like Trenbolone, the way they affect strength gains is not through the androgen receptor, but the way they change the osmolality of how magnesium and calcium function. Like Trenbolone is known to increase calcium channel activity like tenfold. It even makes your heart beat harder and faster. And so the if you go to the gym one day and you think to yourself, man, I just don't have it. I don't understand. Like I got enough sleep and my calories are high. You may be teeter-tottering on being dehydrated, because when you're dehydrated, you will not be able to lift the weight you normally lift. You can't just muscle through it, because the electrical system that fires the impulses to make those muscle fibers contract, it's running on half a battery instead of the whole battery. That's basically what we're talking about here. So, you know, dehydration, people write it off, I'll just drink some water later and I'll be okay. It can actually take you a couple days. A gallon of water without minerals in it, a gallon of water weighs close to 8 pounds. So if you go to the gym and train and you lost 5 pounds, you know, you lost 2/3 of a gallon of water.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of water.
Absolutely.
So what's the next step for the? Are you going to follow through with this research into something else? Are there still some unanswered questions here?
Yeah, there's a couple of areas that we can kind of take it. The first is that even though we have these two studies, it's hardly kind of a open and shut case for this issue. So just take a step back and we can discuss the physiology a little bit. So essentially, like I was saying, what basically happens is as we become dehydrated, we have two different things happening. We have that reduction in volume and an increase in the osmolality, or the salt content of the blood, which is driven by as well glucose as well, but it's mostly sodium chloride. Both of these factors can potentially affect our ability to sweat, dissipate heat, and that sort of thing. In the study, by kind of manipulating osmolality, we were able to kind of just assess that osmolality component while controlling for that volume component. But there were some really subtle differences in the results between the osmolality study and then the kind of frank dehydration study, to the point where it's almost suggesting like that volume component could be also important. And we do know that part of the reason that as we get older and we don't maybe put as much fluid back, we don't get as thirsty for dehydration, is not only because we are less able to sense that increase in osmolality, but actually the effect of changes in blood volume on the on that response are also changed or reduced. So kind of an easy follow-up to this would be, we would have to find some way to manipulate blood volume separately from osmolality, so kind of the reverse study. One way you could do that is with diuretic use. Not the cleanest way to do research, but that would be an interesting line of research. Where I'm mostly kind of interested in taking it, though, is kind of going more for the practical component. So in physiology, we kind of, when we do studies, we have a habit of hitting things with a hammer. We try to get the biggest change in a given physiological system. So if there is an effect of that system, we will be able to see that effect. For instance, in this study with the osmolality, to induce the changes in osmolality, as we saw, the amount of sodium we were actually infusing into the body was about the equivalent of 40 standard sport drinks. So quite a large increase. What is often not done in physiology research, and I really like, it's actually a couple of researchers at the U.S. Army call it this, is we never do what are called 4-minute ab studies. So we know that 5-minute abs is enough to get, you know, shredded six pack, but no one ever thinks maybe 4 minutes is enough.
Right, the lowest effective dose.
Yeah, exactly. So what I'm really interested in doing is kind of, and again, with this study as well, is the people, the older adults in this study, they were physically active. I think the mean VO2 max was 42, and they were around 60 years old, which is quite high. Mm-hmm. So it would be more interesting to kind of change the design. Maybe we go for a prolonged kind of heat wave simulation, or like a walking study, or we kind of simulate more like what a electric utilities worker or a miner would do, mm-hmm. and then see if these same responses hold up. Because very well might happen, this might be an important kind of increase in our knowledge of what's happening on the physiological scale. But whether that actually translates to kind of real life environments is a whole other question. And that's what I'm interested in kind of following up mostly.
We have Stephen Rushing made a comment, and this is an interesting one. This is a compound that most of us know about, glycerol or even glycerin. Any thoughts on glycerol or glycerin in affecting hydration? So are you familiar with its use?
Yeah, very, very peripherally. I know the maybe it was not glycerol, but the some of those studies from the U.S. Army, and I can definitely send you the links for those, have done research, at least from a thermoregulatory perspective, on these kind of, I guess what you would call plasma expansion methods, so ways you can increase blood volume and overhydration. I think weirdly they showed that, and I have to double check this, but overhydration had no change or caused no changes on our ability to like lose heat or regulate core temperature. But weirdly enough, there was some effect of, it might have been glycerol, but it might have been another protein. I can't remember the name. So there is some thoughts there. From a performance perspective, though, I can't really speak to the
effects. So glycerol and glycerin are actually sugar alcohols, believe it mm-hmm. or not. They're considered. They're used in sports a lot. When someone has to make weight and they literally will, you know, sit in a hot box and not drink water, use diuretics, and they get on the scale and they've made their weight. And then literally overnight, by drinking a 16-ounce glass of water with 1 to 2 tablespoonfuls of glycerin or glycerol, and they do that all day long, and the next morning they got like 8 or 10 pounds back on them, and it's all in the muscle. It's all in the muscle. It's amazing, amazing stuff. So yeah, that's a lot of guys use that. So while we're on it, just real quick, if you're one of those people who wakes up all night long to pee, try some glycerol or glycerin. Seriously, you won't wake up in the middle of the night to pee. Your body will just hold the water. So
yeah, this is actually how basically increasing osmolality of the blood. Essentially, that's what it does. Is it's will pull fluid and help hold that fluid. We talk about osmosis and kind of osmotic pressure. I remember one of the comments last a while back was on the sodium in sports drinks.
Yes.
So the thought that those are isotonic is a little bit of a misnomer. They're not isotonic to blood, but isotonic to sweat. And it's not so much, I think, as far as I understand it, that they're designed to put back the sodium you're losing in sweat. Your body sodium stores is pretty large, and for the most time, an hour training, it'd be tough to really drive it down.
Right.
What it's actually doing is, if you drink just plain water, and I guess this is just another kind of area where this becomes confusing, you have this, all the water, let's say, enters the vascular system, you have a driving down of osmolality, and the body says, oh no, we're now hypoosmotic, we need to flush off some of this water. So by adding a little bit of salt, and it doesn't need to be too much, it just helps that prevents that process from happening. So the water you are absorbing is not immediately being kind of processed for excretion.
And pushed out. Right. That's interesting.
And then glycerol would be kind of the same thing. It would be kind of as far as I understand it, non-osmotically or non kind of active. but still would just stay within the vascular system and help, you know, any water you are taking in, and especially that because you've lost so much, you're trying to make weight, that sort of thing, will help it just stay where it needs to be to rehydrate and kind of increase that body weight.
So the only
back up to, you know, pre-cutting levels.
Right. The only individuals who lose weight and keep it off are jockeys, because I worked at the racetrack when I was a kid, and they would sit in the hot box and sweat out 5 pounds. And then, but then they wouldn't replenish it, and they didn't even know anything about electrolytes back then. And they'd get on the horse and they'd ride, and they wouldn't be as strong as they wanted to be on the horse. They would say it. They'd get off, they'd be dizzy, but they had to make weight. You know, it's really funny. Mm-hmm. It's just another athletic performance venue that requires to lose body water quickly.
Yes. I actually did. A couple years of powerlifting, and you could either compete in a 2 hour after your weigh-in or 24 hours, and I would never do the 2 hours. There's no way I'm trying to lift heavy weights after only having 2 hours to replace any body water loss. So,
right? No, yeah,
not interested in that.
No, because you're not gonna be able to perform the way you want to perform. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna take a last commercial break on this particular discussion, and then we're gonna be joined at the top of the hour to talk about an electrolyte blend, which fits nicely into this discussion. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Superhuman Radio.
Want to improve mental energy and focus? Try the new Superhuman Stack from Pure Nootropics. Stack Dynamin, Salbutamin, Theocrine, and Palmitoyl Ethanolamide together and feel the lights go on in your brain. Find your perfect mix of these four. Carl likes one cap of each and two caps of Dynamin. Bam! Lights on. Go to shrnetwork.biz/superhumanstack, all one word, today, and get yours for 25% off plus free shipping. That's shrnetwork.biz/superhumanstack.
Guys, you've heard about this revolutionary acoustic wave technology that improves your sexual performance. It's been used in Europe for 20 years and has a 90% success rate of reversing symptoms of ED. Even if you're not suffering from ED, it can take you back to peak sexual performance of your younger days. The Phoenix uses powerful sound waves to clear plaque blockage and substantially increase blood flow. It's easy to use, has no side effects, and can be done in the privacy of your own home. Doctors have been charging thousands of dollars for these treatments. Go to shrnetwork.biz/phoenix and use the code SHR for a special superhuman deal. Regain your sexual prowess today. My friends over at Bioptimizers, makers of industry-leading digestive supplements, have created a special recipe for you that helps boost brain performance in the morning. They make products Primergen V and Primergen M, potent liquid vitamins and mineral formulas loaded with absorbable vitamin Bs and trace minerals in a fulvic and humic acid base. You stack that with 3 capsules of Capex, their enzyme and energy supplement, and the effect is even stronger. You'll be buzzing without jitters or any negative side effects for hours. Bioptimizers calls this the Brain Boost Stack, and they're running a special promotion for you at shrnetwork.biz/brainstack. That's shrnetwork.biz/brainstack. You can get an additional 10% off from the normal package price with the coupon code SHR10. It's a powerful way to get your brain going and optimize your daily focus, memory, and performance.
Quest Nutrition makes bars, cookies, chips, and pizzas out of complete dairy-based proteins. Our products minimize net carbs and sugar without sacrificing taste. Each delicious chocolate-flavored chip, cookie chunk, and crunchy crumble is custom-made to maintain Quest macros. It's time to enjoy foods that work for you, not against you. It's time to enjoy your Quest.
Proper hydration can lead to improved endurance, performance, and recovery. When we sweat, we lose valuable electrolytes that must be replaced. That's why Element created a zero-sugar, science-backed ratio of electrolytes that you can add to your water. It comes in 3 flavors. Sample them all risk-free with the Element Variety Pack. Carl's favorite is raspberry. Free shipping on all U.S. orders. Go to shrnetwork.biz/LMNT and get yours today.
I love beef. And if you love beef, listen up. I've discovered the best tasting beef in the world, and that's not an exaggeration, at Piedmontese.com. The Piedmontese breed is famous from Italy for being lean and unbelievably tender, with half the fat and calories of traditional beef. Even typically tough cuts are tender when it comes from the Piedmontese cows. And for the first time ever, Piedmontese cows are being raised here in the USA. Get 25% off all beef and free shipping on orders of $100 or more at Piedmontese.com with code SHR. Go to P-I-E-D-M-O-N-T-E-S-E.com.
BONTESE.com and use code SHR today. You will never eat any other type of beef ever again.
This is the Superhuman Channel, doing reps with the weight of the world.
Welcome back. We're talking with Robert Mead. He's a doctoral student at the University of Ottawa about hydration and older men. But really, this is a topic that young athletes have to pay attention to, too, as well, I should say. Because being dehydrated affects your performance, it affects your sleep, it affects the microbiome in your gut. I mean, it affects bone mineralization, it affects everything. And you're right, social cues have changed how we drink, you know? Unfortunately, our ability to ignore signals from the body has become a common thing today. And so people don't even know when they're really thirsty or not. And then they turn to diet soda instead of water. And it's really interesting when you look, you know, chronic kidney disease has been thought to dehydration is understood to play a role in chronic kidney disease. However, it's changing now, the opinions of what is good for CKD and what's bad for CKD. It used to be that high sodium intake was shunned. No, you got to cut your sodium down so your kidneys don't work so hard. And I've had renal specialists on this show, and we've talked about this. The kidneys work the hardest when you're not getting a constant influx of minerals and water, because they have to then blockade and sequester electrolytes from escaping in the body. That's when they work the hardest. When is a dam working the hardest? When it's holding the water back. When they open up the spill wells, the dam isn't working hard because everything is just rushing out. So now they know that if somebody has CKD, they tell them to take 600 milligrams of sodium bicarbonate 3 to 4 times a day. And that's because the added sodium allows the kidneys not to have to work so hard, because sodium is really the primary mineral that the body is trying to manipulate, modulate. So we're learning now. And there's so many dehydrated people out there, they don't even know they're dehydrated because they don't train. They're just average people. What do you think?
Yeah, I'll just preface, of course, that my field is not in kidney. I do read quite a bit about it because it is very interesting. No formal training, though. Kidney is, you're right, it's an amazing organ. It does a lot more than we kind of give it credit for. And as far as I understand it, or I guess the big kind of thought for a while was this whole thing with the salt sensitive hypertension, and that can lead to kidney issues. I think more recently we're starting to kind of, like you said, recalibrate our thinking on that, and it might not be necessarily that we eat too much salt, it puts too much strain on the kidneys become damaged. It might almost be the reverse, that there's some damage we're doing, whether it be not eating right or developing atherosclerosis or whatever it is, that makes our kidneys become salt sensitive. I read a study not too long ago, and essentially if you, the chance of someone becoming, or the chance of a kidney recipient becoming salt sensitive or developing hypertension after the donation is directly proportional to the family risk of the person who donated the kidney. There's a lot more going on there than we give it credit for. But I think now a lot of the research, and I know there is actually a clinical trial coming out of Ottawa, not so much looking at necessarily the effect of sodium intake itself on hypertension and kidney dysfunction, but that sodium potassium ratio. It speaks to the broader point that, and we had mentioned this in the last segment, is that you're 60-65% water. All of the kind of biochemical reactions and all the nerve fire that's going on in your body is happening in this medium. So it plays a role in everything. Means it's very important. At the same time, it also means that hydration interacts with every system in the body, and it makes it a really hard thing to kind of figure out what make heads or tails of what's going on, I think.
So about 5 years ago, I had Dr. James D. Nicolantonio on the show after he had written the book The Salt Fix. The book was fascinating because it actually showed scientifically the inconsistencies of why what happens to the body when you do a low sodium lifestyle. And so after doing that interview, I happened to be at the gym, and a bunch of us guys who train, and we go and sit in the sauna afterwards, and we, you know, shoot the breeze and talk. And my friend Bill, who's an over the road truck driver for FedEx, he said, no, for UPS, I'm sorry. He said to me, they keep raising my blood pressure medication. Now, this guy trains. He does like an hour of cardio. He looks amazing. He's my age. He's in his early 60s now. And he goes, you know, last few times I've been to the doctor, they just keep bumping up my blood pressure meds. And so I said, are you on a low sodium diet? He goes, yeah, I don't eat any salt. He goes, I don't salt anything. If a food has salt, you know, it's like the first five things on the label, he says, I don't even buy it. And I said, how often do you sit in the sauna like this? He goes, 4 or 5 days a week. I said, why don't you buy this book, The Salt Fix, by Dr. James D. Nicolantonio? Read it. I said, and maybe you should start salting your food. Now, this is an N equals one anecdote, blah, 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 all that stuff, right? So we see each other all the time. About 4 months later, he comes back to me. He goes, you're not going to believe this. I said, what? He goes, I'm off my blood pressure medication. I said, how'd that happen? He said, I started putting salt on everything. He said, my doctor kept lowering the dose, and now I'm off it completely. And I said, so all you did differently? He says, all I did differently was I started salting my food. Now, if you told this to a physician, they'd go, oh, it had to be something else. That's a lot of nonsense. That can't be. Salt changes hemodynamics, blah, blah, blah. I think we've gotten it wrong for a long time, and I think that we've literally tortured them and hurt them in the long run by trying to get salt out of their diet completely to fix a problem that was secondary to the salt. You know, mm-hmm. when we talk about the angiotensin converting enzyme, it's sensitive to salt. You know, that metabolic derangement syndrome, you know, now everything affects you differently, everything. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know, and that makes sense. I think a lot of times you start off by sort of treating the symptom, and it's not often, or sometimes you're missing a piece. And then there are, you know, the body is, we're discovering things all the time. Angiotensin converting enzyme, a great example. It actually apparently exists within the vasculature of the body. And so that's actually one of the kind of lines of research right now is that it could just be not, again, the salt content, but that sodium-potassium ratio literally in the walls of the vasculature that is potentially causing hypertension in some people. I mean, when you look into the literature, we as, you know, as just scientific enterprise or whatever you want to call it, we really don't understand hypertension to the degree that would be, you know, good to help treat it. So
yeah. And yet they prescribe medications for it. Exactly. You're exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. And certainly these medications do work for, you know, I'm not sure on actual numbers, but most of the people.
Yeah.
All these problems can be, again, like high blood pressure could be caused by, you know, there's many factors, the vasculature, you know,
onset of insulin resistance. Like that's the number one reason why people are on blood pressure meds, because they're already becoming diabetic. And that's the number mm-hmm. one reason. Most of these people, they address their insulin resistance. Lo and behold, their blood pressure gets better. You mm-hmm. know? So what do you want people to take away from your research, Robert?
This research, I suppose just, you know, we do – it is an important step forward, I think. Not a small step. It's not a leap by any means, but it just goes to show how kind of complicated hydration and this kind of study is. Just maybe if everyone, when it gets hot outside, if you're going for a run, just pay attention to how you feel, how thirsty you are. You know, are you losing too much weight, that sort of thing. I'm certain your training, just feeling will be better. But then understand as well that in terms of our kind of messaging that we hear all the time about hydration, it's very complicated, and there's a lot of work that still needs to be done.
Yes,
as well.
It is a lot of moving parts when we talk about hydration. Listen, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Tyler Cartwright, and we're going to talk about an electrolyte product that I'm crazy about. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Superhuman Radio.
Do you remember those delicious toaster pastries you had when you were a kid? You know, the rectangular sugar-filled snacks? Well, guess what? Legendary Foods has just made low-carb toaster pastry. This is the first of its kind, and honestly, these things are amazing. They have 3 to 4 net carb, less than 1 gram of sugar, and 9 grams of protein. You can eat them right out of the wrapper or lightly toast them. The only question is, which flavor? Strawberry or brown sugar cinnamon? They're available at eatlegendary.com and Amazon.
Everybody wants to feel better, be healthier, and happier. If you don't sweat profusely on a regular basis, you won't feel as good as you could. Studies have shown the power of infrared sauna. Infrared penetrates 1 to 2 inches into the body. It helps those with back pain, fibromyalgia, arthritis, depression, and anxiety. Patients get relief from infrared sauna. The Good Health Sauna has been shown to be an exercise mimetic, conveying many of the same benefits as cardio. There are a lot of reasons people buy a Good Health Sauna, but the bottom line is you will be a much happier, healthier person by using the Good Health Sauna every day. You'll crave it, you'll love it, and it will be the best purchase you have ever made. Good Health Saunas provide commercial-grade saunas for in-home and commercial use, backed by the best lifetime warranty in the industry. Unmatched customer service and the best financing makes owning one easy and will fit any budget. Go to goodhealthsauna.com/superhumanradio to learn more and save 25% off.
New Mass Pro Synthogen X2 just upped its own legendary game. To distance itself even further from the rest of the pack, Synthogen X2 now has double the key active ingredients. If you've ever wondered what steroid-like recovery feels like, Synthogen X2 delivers. See why others compare it favorably to powerful bodybuilding drugs at Synthogen.com. Mass Pro Synthogen. When you train with it, you'll gain with it.
Are you still on the fence about Body Protection Complex BPC Oral from DrSeeds.com? Listen to Maggie Kuhn, one of the owners of the C-Bus Lifting Company gym in Columbus, Ohio.
I had been having some nagging tendon issues that weren't injuries, just things that were annoying. You know, I'm 58 years old, so it's just older tendon kind of issues. For us powerlifters, you know, we really don't stop training when we have just nagging issues. We just kind of keep pushing through. And I started the BPC. What I noticed was I was doing some heavy tricep stuff that would have killed me before when I had an elbow problem, and I was able to do this with literally no pain at all.
Go to DrSeeds.com, DrSeeds.com. Use coupon code SHR and save 20% off your bottle of BPC Body Protection Complex today.
Chronic stress leaves us tired, distracted, and physically vulnerable. Apollo Neuro is here to help you take control. Apollo Neuro is a new wearable that trains your nervous system to be more resilient to stress. Apollo's gentle vibrations use your sense of touch to help you recover from stress, going from fight or flight to rest and digest, so you can relax, get to sleep, focus, and stay healthy. Developed by physicians and neuroscientists, Apollo Neuro has been tested in multiple clinical trials and is proven to improve heart rate variability, the key biometric of stress. Special offer for friends of Superhuman Radio. Try Apollo Neuro today and get 15% off your purchase at apolloneuro.com/superhuman. That's apolloneuro.com/superhuman.
Proper hydration can lead to improved endurance, performance, and recovery. When we sweat, we lose valuable electrolytes that must be replaced. That's why Element created a zero-sugar, science-backed ratio of electrolytes that you can add to your water. It comes in 3 flavors. Sample them all risk-free with the Element Variety Pack. Carl's favorite is raspberry. Free shipping on all U.S. orders. Go to shrnetwork.biz/LMNT and get yours today.
Spit that out right now. This is the Superhuman Channel.
Welcome back. You know, I didn't know we were doing the Element interview on the tail end of this interview we just did about hydration, but thank you, Elisa Profumo, because she's a genius when it comes to booking the interviews. How are you, Tyler?
Doing wonderful. I was going to say, I think that the conversation's already been had, so I was just going to hang out for 30 minutes.
I know, right? It was like, I was like, how do I save some of this stuff for when Tyler comes on? Because it's pertinent to the earlier interview. But it's okay. It's okay. So, you know, I am a huge proponent of understanding our evolutionary edicts. You know, 40,000 years versus, you know, 2.2 million years. Okay, so we've evolved under the access of certain things and under the pressure of certain things. And we have always consumed water that had minerals in it, always, for 2-point-something million years. Now we have modern sanitation and filtration and all this other stuff. And people think that because they're drinking spring water, oh, well, this is spring water. No, it's spring water that's been highly processed, highly filtered. That's why if your spring water says low sodium, it's no longer spring water. Because we were in Ireland, and we drank from a 6,000-year-old aquifer that they bottle water at, so we could see the label. I mean, there was sodium, calcium, magnesium, bicarbonates. There were all these minerals in there. And I got to be honest with you. I told Elisa, like, when I drank that water, I felt hydrated. I didn't feel like I was always thirsty every 5 seconds. And then you come to the United States, and I contacted Deer Park once, and they will send you their mineral chart. And it's all the mineral charts are 0-2, either 0 or up to this. And so I contacted the customer service. I said, why does it say 0-2? Why does it say 114 milligrams per liter of this? She says, well, because the filtration process removes a lot of it, so we really don't know. It's like this is the range that it could be in. This is not mineral water. This is not spring water anymore.
It really isn't. I mean, you know, anything that we do to remove minerals, I mean, any filtration that we do, right, is going to take whatever was in the water out. In some cases, that may be good, right? Pathogens and things that can kill us are wonderful to get rid of. But it's sometimes, I think, a little baby with the bathwater. It's just kind of gets thrown out whether you intend for it to or not, because you can't filter one without the other. It's the, you know, love and marriage. It's a Sinatra song, right?
So. Yeah. Yeah. So you guys came up with Element. And one of the reasons I love Element is because it's just about minerals. There are several other products on the market that claim to be mineral additives for your water, electrolyte additives for your water. They all have artificial colors or natural colors. They have colors in them. I don't know why. They all have B6 in them. I've talked about B6 on this show for a long time. More people have B6 toxicity than they know, because everything is fortified with B6 today, and it's synthetic B6. And when I saw this didn't have any B6 in it, I was like, oh my God, this is fantastic. And the other thing is, there's no sugar in it. Like, why does your water have to have a taste other than the minerals themselves? I don't understand that.
You know, it's funny. We go to trade shows sometimes, and people come up and they try the flavored stuff with us, and we do some flavored things, all using stevia. And then we'll have a container of the raw formula that's there, so it's literally just minerals added to water. And they're like, "Oh, I bet it tastes like the ocean." We take a drink and see. And honestly, people take it and they go. And it sits in the back of their throat for a second before they swallow, and then they just think to themselves, huh. And you can see the little hamster with the wheel turning in their forehead. Like, you just see, like, the light bulb is slowly getting brighter over their head, and they go, wait a minute, that doesn't taste overpoweringly salty. I'm like, well, yeah, it's going to have some salty taste to it, because there's salt in it, go figure. But you don't need to drink the ocean. You just need to replace the minerals that both we're not getting in our diet because, you know, a host of reasons, and secondly, that we're not really putting back into our diet nearly to the level that we need to for maximum human performance. So,
well, let's talk about that for a second. So this is something that I find shocking that most people don't know either. So the average person, when they train, will sweat 3 to 4 liters per hour. And even afterwards, the rest of your day, because you know when you train, you sweat the rest of the day, right? It raises metabolic rate. They'll end up sweating out 10 liters in a day. Most of it just gets wicked away. It just keeps your skin cool. You don't feel it. You don't build up beads or droplets of it. And it's estimated that hard training athletes to easy training athletes will expend up to 2,300 milligrams of sodium per liter. Now, think about this. On every single stupid box of food, they recommend that you only get 2,200 milligrams of sodium a day. Is it any wonder that people are developing chronic kidney disease if they actually need 10,000 to replace what they went through and they're giving themselves 2,000? And where is that sodium coming from? It's robbing it from bone mineral.
You know, it's funny. Well, funny is not the right word. It's pissing me off is what it does. But this idea that we should just ignore the data, right? I saw like Alan Aragon in his research review last month, I guess, put out an article that's like, thank God somebody else is finally carrying this torch for a while. The clinical data on sodium intakes and relative risk and CVD risk show that in a range of about 4 to 6 grams per day for the average person, that those risks are at their lowest. They're at the trough of a J curve or a U curve with a really long tail. But yet we're still advocating for, quite frankly, completely unsubstantiated, you know, data to say, hey, don't eat more than 2,000 or 2,400 or 1,800 milligrams of sodium a day. And I'm like, okay, here's the thing. One of the biggest challenges we have is we don't appreciate that sodium and potassium kind of work like a tug-of-war rope to keep stuff in the middle. And so we have sick soil, we have really poor farming practices, really poor agricultural practices that have been brought about by price pressures and land pressures and a host of other things. And the data that we're using to calculate how much of this stuff is in our food is from the Atwater data from the 1940s. Long before we got into confined animal agriculture, long before we got into monocrop, you know, soil pillaging, you know, sort of infrastructure, you know, actually a little shout out here. Dinah Rogers and Rob Wolf just released a book talking about a lot of these very topics, but we have no freaking clue what's actually in the mineral composition or the vitamin composition of the foods. If we're getting to the foods that grandma and grandpa used to eat, mm-hmm. right? We're not talking about the box stuff where it's more synthetic than it is natural. You know, we have no idea. And what we found, especially coming from my background in training and eating lower carb, you just tank, you just die if you don't keep that sodium level to a point that would cause doctors to scratch their head like cavemen and try and figure out what's going on. You know, there are days when I'll train, you know, 2 hours in jiu-jitsu and an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours in the gym, and it'd be nothing for me to consume 15 to 20 grams of salt in the course of a day. And it should absolutely flabbergast people, but I'm also intentionally taking in potassium. I'm eating diet that's, you know, that's very lightly refined, that's intentionally focused on nutrient densities, but not synthetic nutrient densities where we can avoid that kind of thing, right? And so if I tried to take somebody and put them into that environment, even a fairly well-trained person, and I put them against an equally well-trained person with a higher dose intake of sodium and potassium, the equally well-trained person with the higher intake of electrolytes is going to still be running like when the Energizer bunny banging that drum when the other guys are just falling over in the floor and passing out. It's crazy. Just the anecdotal data alone is absurd. But I mean, Carl, you're an older dude like me. You remember what you did in football practice when you were dying. What'd they do? They handed you salt caps, right? And what happened? Magic.
Right.
You perked right up and you went right back on the field. The right. cramps went away. And I actually had an opportunity years ago to try a hermetically sealed, unopened bottle of the original formula of Gatorade.
It had niacin in it, right? It had niacin in it.
it was the nastiest tasting, saltiest compound I've ever put in my mouth, to the point that like my lips puckered and they were dry through the course of the day.
Right.
And the conversation I had with the gentleman that had it, he said, you know, before it got sold, like the patent and all this stuff, it was an electrolyte drink, but now it's sugar water.
Yes. In fact, Dr. Heiser lives here in Louisville, and he worked with the University in Florida that developed Gatorade. And the original blend had niacin in it because niacin suppresses free fatty acid release from the liver and increases growth hormone production. If you take 100 to 200 milligrams of real niacin, not the slow niacin or anything, every 15 minutes, you will have a massive increase in growth hormone production during your training. I did it. I tried it. I walked around the gym looking like a lobster for a while. and I was itchy as hell all the time. But he said they had to take it out because the players didn't like the flushing feeling, that you know, the itchiness and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, it was actually a scientific blend. Now it's akin to soda with some salt in it.
Well, and what frustrates me is what's the message that you see, right? Like the commercials, even as far back as when I was in high school, right? It was, you know, be like Mike, drink the Gatorade. It was, you know, you can jump like LeBron if you drink the Gatorade. And I mean, we look back as adults and go, oh, that's stupid. Nobody can believe it. Have you met kids? Like, I love them. I'm the proud father of a 9-year-old. They're not terribly adept at separating reality from fantasy.
Right.
And so you get them hooked on this drink early on because drink companies know the same thing that credit card companies know, that there is loyalty and brand identity. It's the reason that they spend millions and millions of dollars supporting paying athletes to be on Wheaties boxes, paying athletes to be Gatorade drinkers. It's utterly absurd. And the amount of electrolyte that you would need to get. We actually did the math on this on a single pouch of Element in 16 ounces of water. You would need, I think it was 5 16-ounce or 5 24-ounce Gatorades. I can't remember which the number was. But we actually did it's like, and so literally you're taking 35 to 40 grams of sugar times 5. In what world should you be drinking 150 grams of sugar in a single intake?
It's crazy. I use Element in the morning before I go train. I literally I fill up my jug and I pour 2 packets in there, and I sip it through the morning before I go to the gym. I use it before training because Dr. James DiNicolantonio, who I mentioned earlier, you know who he is, right? The salt fix guy.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I do. Yes.
I mean, he talked about like using salt as a pre-workout. Just take it before you go to the gym. It's the God's honest truth. You train longer, you feel better, you feel stronger. And like people will say to me, my God, that's so much salt. And I think to myself, yeah, it's going to be on my shirt at the end of the session. You know, it's going to just pour out of my body. It's not like as though it's going to stay in there and hurt me or something like that. And when you look at that, that was one of the things that a lot of the early paleo guys, Rob, Lauren Cordain, there was a problem. Because there were these non-sequiturs, right? So Rob was real big omega-3s early on. And one of the things I credit Rob with is when he realizes he got something wrong, he goes, oh, I got that wrong, so here's the new data. He doesn't dig his heels in and protect his little fiefdom. And I have a lot of respect for Rob for that reason. He's been on the show numerous times. But early on, it was like, well, wait a minute. If I eat like this, if I eat like a caveman, I'm going to be getting 6,500 milligrams of sodium a day. Oh, God, yeah, wait a minute. So there was this disconnect between what modern dietary recommendations were and how our Paleolithic ancestors ate. But the reality is it's because the modern dietary recommendations are complete hogwash.
Yeah, you're absolutely spot on. And an interesting little side note, one of the early pieces, and I will double down, and you know, Rob's a personal friend and has been for years, long before we decided to launch Element. You know, I've never met a more willing student to learn things than I ever have in that man. And he has taught me more than I think most people, you know, have probably forgotten. You know, but it's interesting you look at some of the early recommendations, especially like Dr. Cordain, and I want to give a shout out that the guy was pushing the envelope of what was out there, but Paleo Man only ate lean meats and eschewed salt and mineral licks or mineral deposits. And I'm like, horse shit. I'm sorry, but there's no data from which you can make those conclusions. And, you know, unfortunately, I think that narrative stuck early in paleo. And I think that when we consider modern lifestyles and how to apply paleo, if you want to go down that path, you do probably need to eat some leaner cuts of meat because you don't live with tapeworms and bacteria in your gut all the time. You don't live in an outdoor cave where you're being chased down by snakes on a regular basis and being exposed to 110 degree hot days. There is a reason that they could get away with not counting calories and doing all the, you know, the stuff that isn't really germane to how we live right
today,
now.
Right.
And, you know, I think the same situation exists with respect to a product like Element. You know, we don't have natural sources of water. We don't, I mean, we do, but they're difficult to get a hold of. We don't have, you know, mineral dense animals because they're eating grass from mineral dense soil. We don't have those things anymore. And so we need to be intentional and methodological, if you will, focused on how we ingest those electrolytes. And people have gotten, a little twisted up with things like, well, why don't you use Himalayan salt? Why don't you use, for the same reason, Carl, that I don't, for the same reason that you said just a second ago, you don't really know what you're getting when you get that stuff, and you have no idea how it was mined, where it came from. And like a great example, good friends with the guys at Redmond Salt. They make a great salt product. But when it comes to supplementation, it's the one area in life where you don't need to guess. You need to be intentional when you're using a peptide, when you're using supplements. That is the one time where I'm like, look, don't go whole food. Don't go lightly refined. Let's get a concentrated, known amount so that you can titrate that dose around your training, around your lifestyle, around your recovery, around all of these things. And it's funny that like people go, where is it coming from? And how does it like the ground actually comes from the ocean. It's not that salt only kind of comes from a handful of places. So you're either blasting it out or you're harvesting it out of the water bodies or whatever. And so, there is just such a misrepresentation of the data on electrolyte requirements in general. And honestly, powerlifting's been telling us this for years and nobody was really listening. Guys like Stan Efferding have been shouting about this, Deep Pasquale. I mean, there's been so many people in that fitness and health space that have gone, I feel better, I train better, I recover better, I sleep better when I have a proper amount of electrolytes. I mean, going so far back as the old, lemon salt water shot thing that you would do in the morning sometimes before you'd get up and get through your day. It's absurd.
And it was the salt water that was the magic, not the lemon.
Absolutely. The lemon just made it taste less salty. Yeah. But, but the thing is like there are a lot of things in nutritional science that I take issue with. But it is criminal what we are doing with respect to the narrative and the message around electrolytes in general and sodium in specific.
Right.
It's laughable. I mean, and somebody that day was like, well, what about somebody with a heart condition? It's like, well, my father's a heart attack survivor and he is seeing a cardiologist who put the last name together when my dad mentioned that we have an electrolyte company. And he's like, oh my God, I have boxes of it here and I give it away to every heart patient that I have that's on Lasix that complains about being fatigued. He's literally giving away boxes of this stuff every month because he's helping people to realize that the sodium and the potassium in proper balance are what keep fluid levels appropriate. So you don't go hypotensive. You don't wind up hypertensive. And, kind of to the point that Robert was making earlier, absolutely there are people that are salt sensitive hypertensives. And we absolutely should pay attention to those folks. We should focus and understand not everybody is a cookie cutter rubber stamp. Complete thing I get to say because I'm not a doctor and I'm not a nutritionist. I have a suspicion that those people are metabolically dysfunctional in some way and that the salt sensitive hypertension is actually a consequence of a
metabolic
physiological problem. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It is not the primary.
I mean, think about it. They're carb sensitive, theoretically. Mm-hmm. If you're metabolically deranged, you're carb sensitive. Why not be sodium sensitive too? I mean, it makes perfect sense. These people are already broken, and sure, giving them a lot of sodium just brings out how broken they are. So with that being said, there are people who say they're sensitive to sodium. That if, like I have a friend, we'll go out to eat, and the next day he'll say to me, oh, that food must have had a lot of sodium in it because I feel puffy today. Is there a break in, like if you've been living an inappropriately low sodium way of life, is there a rebound period? Like you add sodium, get ready, you're going to hold water, but like a week into it, 2 weeks into it, it all regulates itself out?
So one of the things that happens in general, and I'll answer the question first, I think that there is a loading period that needs to happen. If you're used to eating low sodium and all of a sudden you go to having 6 grams of salt a day, you're going to swell up like the Macy's Day blimp. you're going to feel awful. And you'll probably spend most of the day in the bathroom. You know, but when you start, it's like with anything, right? You don't, you know, somebody's using TRT, if somebody's doing pellet therapies, if somebody's doing, you know, whatever, you know, you don't jump into the middle of jiu-jitsu with nothing but black belts and expect not to get your butt kicked right. every time you come off the mats, right? Right. You don't, you know, you don't go into a powerlifting meet and compete four weight classes above your weight because you want a challenge. You're going to get destroyed.
Right.
The reality is you don't start going from 1,800 milligrams a day to 8,000 milligrams a day and wondering why they used to use salt water as an enema. Yeah. You'll find out real, real fast what happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
However, I think that what's interesting is if you look at the studies on non-deranged kidneys, right? So folks that are not suffering from chronic kidney disease, the amount of sodium and potassium that those kidneys can excrete over the course of even 5 or 10 minutes is absurd.
Right.
It's in the range of about 20 grams.
Wow.
So just let that soak in for a minute and think about the implications when we say, oh, it's hard on kidneys to have 6 grams over the course of a day. And you know, a lot of the swelling that I've noticed and a lot of the blood pressure issues seem to happen more when somebody is completely out of bounds in a really, in like a relative relationship between sodium and potassium. Again, getting back to the point, they need to be kind of like two ends of a rope pulling everything to the middle. If you're eating 6 grams of salt and you're getting, you know, 2 grams of potassium total a day, you're probably going to feel a whole lot better if you start upping potassium in
right.
your diet or
right.
finding ways to supplement more potassium. People do well in about a 1-to-2 up to about a 2-to-1 range as a general rule with coaching clients that mm-hmm. we've had. But there are some folks who just blow out the sodium. I mean, I've got a client who's a runner who's, I think, at about 6-to-1. She's taking about 18 grams a day of salt right now. Blood pressure is almost borderline low. You know, we're having to feed her additional carbohydrate just to keep her blood pressure from dipping down. When we first got to working with her, she was metabolically inflexible, PCOS, everything under the sun. And guess what happened when we gave her salt? She bloated up and her blood pressure skyrocketed. And, you know, all, and she was like, oh, I'm done, I'm out. And then magically, you know, we get her healthy, we get her stable, and then all of a sudden she is perfectly capable of handling huge loads of sodium.
And how does she feel with that high sodium intake?
She, the other day, ran 25 miles before heading back to the house and picking up her kids and going for a hike into the park or whatever. And I was like, I wouldn't drive 25 miles right now. I mean, granted, I've got roughed up knees, but you know, the reality is like, I mean, she's killing it. There's no fatigue. And you know, the dirty little secret, and I think you alluded to it right as I was coming on in the background. One of the things that people don't appreciate is sodium's involvement in the sleep-wake cycle and sodium's involvement with respect to, you know, the HPA axis and
so,
how.
In fact, I tried to get someone on the show last month. They just published a show about how sodium interacts with circadian rhythm and the suprachiasmatic nuclei. And she wouldn't come on. She doesn't have the time. She's writing a grant. But it's like sodium is so important, and it's been demonized. And actually, to speak about kidneys, because I talked about this in the earlier interview, but when someone has chronic kidney disease, the way that they stop the progression of the kidney disease is to get them to take either sodium bicarbonate or sodium chloride. Now, think about that. And the reason, it makes perfect sense. We've talked about it on the show. The kidneys are a filter. And if you can imagine them making the filter hole smaller or larger in order to regulate fluid flow. Well, when are they working the hardest? When those little holes are the tiniest and it has to push stuff through. When are they doing that? When they're trying to blockade electrolytes from escaping because you're not getting enough coming in. But when you get a lot of salt in your diet, the kidneys don't have to work. They just open up. They're like, oh, we got sodium coming in like every couple minutes here, and they open up. They're not working hard. They work less when you have adequate intake of electrolytes. They don't work harder. And that has been my opinion is that has been a health-destroying misinformation that physicians have been passing around for decades now. And I believe – because think about this too, Tyler – if your glomerular filtration rates slow down in an effort to keep salt from escaping, isn't that going to raise your blood pressure?
It should, okay. Because you're retaining fluid, quite frankly, because you're trying. And that's the thing people don't appreciate is how tight the bounds are with sodium and potassium in serum. Like, I mean, you know, the lane is very narrow. It's like the death road or whatever in like Peru, wherever it is, with like the big mountain pass. Like, left side's death, right side's death. And it is a very, very narrow road that you're driving down. That's how good the body is at excreting or retaining sodium and potassium. People just don't appreciate that. And so they have this misapplied concept that, oh, I shouldn't have sodium much. And also the one that's like, I shouldn't have it at night. And I'm like, well, look, I mean, here's the reality. I have talked with a number of people most recently, I think was Chris Masterjohn briefly about, you know, the idea that sodium taken before bed actually helps with some of the, I've got to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and go take a leak. That happens and we just go, oh, it's just a symptom of age and it's prostate and it's all this stuff. Not really. It's probably a symptom, again, not a doctor, but it's probably a symptom that your kidneys are having to work their butt off to try and retain stuff. And then when they finally have, when the insulin load goes down, when everything settles down after a while and you go through part of that sleep-wake cycle, all of a sudden your body's like, oh, shit, now I've got all of this fluid I've got to get rid of in order to protect this. So where does it go? It wakes you up and gives you a dream where you're peeing nonstop and you get up and you go to the restroom and you handle your business.
Right.
And then you sit up there in the bed for an hour and you wonder why your sleep is crap and why your recovery is crap. And you haven't had 8 solid hours of sleep in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. And so what's the answer?
How can I use Element before bed? How much do I take?
So I typically will do a whole pack, but I did have to work myself up to it a little bit there. Mm-hmm. I think I would tell people to start probably with a half a pack, and I know that's a little tough to do because it's a, you know, but the easy path is just kind of sprinkle it onto like a milligram scale if you've got one handy. And then just pour it into liquid and just see how you do with that dose before you start to make modifications. But, you know, honestly, I see a lot of folks just throw a single pack in at night and then they'll throw another one in when they get up and get going in the morning. A lot of times, like using the chocolate for coffee is a great option if people are coffee drinkers, you know, or for that matter, I've seen some people using the orange for like a Chevalier coffee kind of a thing too. But, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, I use about 2 to 3 packs a day. I'll use one around training time. I'll use one in the morning. And most nights I'll use one at night as well. And that seems to keep things just kind of chunking right along like it's supposed to. And it's been a strategy that's worked for a lot of our clients and folks in our communities as well.
I'm actually helping a guy who's got real sleep disturbances and we've done a lot of work on him already. He's not snoring. He doesn't have obstructive sleep apnea. GABA gets him to fall asleep, but he gets up and his problem is he pees 2, 3, 4 times a night. And mm-hmm. I'm gonna turn him on to this. That's why I asked. How do you and an easy solution to split a pack? I would just mix the whole thing, drink half the solution, and put the rest in the refrigerator till tomorrow. Then you don't need to
just make sure you keep it shaken up. Keep it shaken up.
Yeah. So shake it.
Is it
drink
well
it
over time? Settle yeah, out. Yeah.
So there you go. All right. So those of you watching and listening, Element is now a sponsor of Superhuman Radio, and as always, always patronize the sponsors because they make the show possible. And if you go to shrnetwork.biz/LMNT, and that's all caps, capital LMNT, shrnetwork.biz/LMNT, you'll be taking to the website. This stuff is so ridiculously inexpensive that, like, trying to come up with a coupon code is nonsense. How do you guys handle shipping? Is it...
So there's a couple of things we'll do. For your listeners that are outside the U.S., we actually will do free shipping on orders over $100. We're just going to eat in the shorts, the you know, the thing. They may see a charge, but it's actually that we're handling the duties and the import nonsense. We are actively working to try and grow localized presences in those countries just to give people a little bit of a break on that. With respect to folks in the United States, shipping is free, you know, anywhere in the United States. So, you know, we also have got a return policy that's as simple as tell us you hate it and we'll give you your money back. We've done not very many of those, I'll say it that way, over the last 2 years. But, you know, we stand behind our product. And if you don't like it, just let us know. And all we've ever asked, we don't even want it back. Just give it to somebody you think might benefit or that might enjoy it and see what they think. Right. And, you know, a great option if you're in a gym, if you're a jiu-jitsu guy, if you're a, you know, a runner, whatever, give it to somebody that's in that sport. Give it to somebody that can actually use it and see what they think. I mean, I'd love to hear back from those folks.
Yeah, and if you do try it and you like it or don't like it, email me at onair@superhumanradio.net. But I like the raspberry, but I'm starting to like the orange salt too. I like the flavor of that. You have some tropical flavors too, right?
So mango. We do. We actually, yeah. So my business partner is Luis Villasenor, who's a Mexican gentleman, and we wanted to kind of have some fun and pay homage to the fact that, you know, a lot of the flavors that we enjoy were sort of Mexican infused. And so we ended up doing a combination for the chocolate salt, which is a little savory, but also we have a mango chili and then also a lemon habanero, which are both kind of inspired by, you know, heat plus sweet or heat plus, you know, plus that salty element as well. So I have been told, by the way, that for what it's worth, a lemon habanero sprinkled on watermelon is amazing, and 'tis the season for those late watermelons, just FYI. Yeah. So might be worth a try for those of you that are watermelon folks.
That's another thing. Can you season your food with it?
Absolutely. We have folks with the lemon, or this me, the mango chili right now. There's been a bunch of folks on like Facebook and other places saying, I just put this on my chicken wings. Like, I'll air fry chicken wings and I'll throw this stuff on there, and it's freaking amazing. And I was like, I'm willing to try a lot of chicken wing flavors because I'm a chicken wing dude, but I just can't get my brain around, you know, around it. But, you know, sweet and heat is really what a lot of chicken wing flavors carry, right? Yeah. You know, so it makes some sense. You know, I've thought for a while. I will say I have used the orange in some Asian type dishes, and I've also used the citrus in like some Mexican meat dishes to give it sort of that lemon lime thing. But yeah, so there's a lot of folks doing just that, and also freezing them as like popsicles for the kids.
Oh, that's a great idea. That's really, really a good idea. I like that a lot. Again, go to shrnetwork.biz/LMNT, and the LMNT are all caps, and try it. You will not be dissatisfied. Since I've given up caffeine, I've had to find new things to do as pre-workouts, and this is one of them. I love it. I love it a lot. I want to thank you for being a sponsor, and I also want to thank you for making time to come on the show today.
I appreciate it, Carl. Thanks.
Take care. And then tomorrow we have the Blueprint Power Hour, so be sure to tune in for that, where we will answer your questions about training, nutrition, drugs, everything, anything that you want to talk about. And that's it for today. Thank you for watching. Don't forget, share the show. Help some people get healthy and live longer. We'll see you tomorrow with more Superhuman Radio.